Well, hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's 3 o'clock. Pat Moore here, hosting Juno Afternoon today. Well, nice to be back in town. Anyway, weather looks like we're going to have same thing we got. Mostly cloudy, isolated rain and snow showers, highs around 34, northeast winds 10 miles per hour. And in the midst of that, we have a wonderful lineup of guests today. Lance Twitchell is coming here from UAS to talk about the UAS Alaska Native language classes he's been writing about in the newspaper. Pat Race will come in to tell us about submitting work for the Jump Society Film Festival. The deadline is the 18th. Doug Duskowski will be here to talk about Juno Co-op Preschool, and we'll hear about Writer's Almanac music and a little bit more, as always, on KTOO News. So you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Juno Afternoon.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Colville Confederated Tribes of the state of Washington have authorized a wolf hunt on their reservation. Steve Jackson has more on the story.
Although the number of confirmed wolves on the Colville Reservation is low, tribal officials say the carnivores have been killing animals that some tribal members normally kill for food. John Cyrus is the head of the Tribal Business Council.
This policy really was a challenge, I guess, to come to, because we do have significant culturally ties to the wolf, you know, in our culture as well. So I think a lot of people were surprised as well, but this is a part of maintaining a balance. We don't want to unduly, you know, put stress on the elk and deer populations, having a wolf population that's too large.
Cyrus says it's estimated there are 30 wolves on the reservation. Hunting has been approved in three areas with a total of 9 animals allowed to be taken. Cyrus says the tribe wants to avoid the situation that took place in northeast Washington in late 2012 when a cattleman's complaint about depredation prompted the state Fish and Wildlife Agency to kill an entire pack believed responsible.
You know, just going through with a helicopter and slaughtering, you know, an entire pack, it didn't sit well with us, and that, and I don't think that style of management fits us as a tribe. So we wanted to take a different tact.
Cyrus says the decision to hold the wolf hunt has been very controversial. The Colville tribe did hold consultation with state and federal authorities before approving the hunt. So far, no wolves have been killed. The hunt is authorized to continue until the end of February. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
A leader in healthcare services for Native Americans died in New Mexico this week. Josephine Wakanda was a member of Isleta Pueblo. She was 77 years old. Wakanda spent 30 years working in healthcare. She was the first American Indian woman to achieve the rank of Rear Admiral in the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service. She was also the director of the Indian Health Service for the Albuquerque area for more than a decade. Josephine Wakanda was the daughter of Miguel Trujillo. Her father played a key role in securing voting rights for Native Americans in New Mexico. Trujillo filed a successful lawsuit in 1948 after he was denied the opportunity to register to vote. Services for Wakanda will be held this weekend at Isleta Pueblo. Alaska's legislature begins meeting later this month with a smaller Native contingent. It's the first time in more than two decades that no Tlingit or Haida Indians are in office. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
Republican Bill Thomas and Democrat Albert Kukesh served a combined 24 years in the state's House and Senate. They represented mostly villages and small cities populated by Alaska Natives. Both are Tlingit Indians, the largest indigenous group in the state's southeast region, also called the Panhandle, and both lost re-election bids to non-natives.
It's simply not possible, so far as I can see, for two men who are non-native to have the perspective of native people.
That's Dennis Demard, a Tlingit leader and former director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Native Studies program. He says the winning candidates are sympathetic, but it's just not the same.
There are needs that we have and priorities that we're aware of from living our lives in villages and so forth that they can observe and see, but they can't experience the way we have.
The loss came after redistricting added larger communities with more non-natives to traditionally small city districts. Alaska's legislature still has 6 Native lawmakers, but they represent communities far from Southeast's panhandle. For National Native News, this is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
During this week in 2001, Washington State's Chinook tribe gained federal recognition. This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Let's begin the program today with a little bit of music from the Dave Haskell Group. Hey, music by a fellow named, let me get that, Dave Haskell. Yeah, okay. Haskell is an interesting guy. He had quite a music career in San Francisco and then wound up becoming an airline pilot. And when that career was over, he went back to playing jazz. He's quite an accomplished, as you heard, accomplished jazz guitarist. All of the pieces, except for two of them on this new album that we've got here at the station called Pivot Point by the Dave Haskell Group, were written by Haskell himself. So quite a jazz pianist, or jazz guitarist. And we have another guitarist with us as our first guest today. George Kuhar is here and is getting set to do a concert here just in the nearly immediate future. Hi, George.
Hello.
Hey, what's coming up?
Well, for the past 3 years, I've made a habit out of, or a tradition, rather. Tradition is a better word than habit. Made a habit of a new tradition of playing a solo show on or around my birthday. Year, my birthday falls on a Saturday, so I'm playing a solo acoustic performance.
Your hair's not gray, so I can ask what year.
Well, don't you see those few gray ones on my beard there? They weren't like that last winter.
Okay.
I'm going to be turning 33.
33.
Yes.
Hey,
that's an auspicious number.
Auspicious number. Yeah. What is three? Is three completion? I can't remember.
Three is creation.
Creation. Okay. Yeah. All right. I don't know my numerology as well as I probably should, but so 3-3 is double creation. This should be a very creative concert.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to actually be pulling out a bunch of songs from spanning several years. I've been writing songs since I was 12 or 13, I think, and I'm just going to try and get a good mix across the years.
So I'm going to steal a question from my favorite interviewer, because she just asked this on the preceding show.
Can we say borrow, please?
Okay. But what she asked has a bearing here. She was talking to a gospel singer, and you bill yourself as a gospel for the antiquarian age, your music.
Mm-hmm.
How much of your music before you came to that was secular?
Oh, well, quite a bit, although... I've been writing kind of spiritual songs for quite some time. I was raised in the Catholic Church, and I sang in the choir at church, and I'm not a practicing Catholic at this time. But you can't lose that, you know, like they say, once a Catholic, always a Catholic, once a whatever, always a this or that, once a Texan, always a Texan. So that has always been with me, and it's always certainly been an undertone or an overtone or possibly both in my music for quite a long time. I've certainly written a lot of songs that seem to be void of that, but it seems to me that more often than not, it's always been there.
The gospel component to it, or well, gospel may not be quite the correct word.
I know what you're taking the word
for
gospel
here,
as meaning. Something that is the word of an authoritative word.
Yeah. Okay.
And in my case, you know, I believe it to be the authoritative word of my heart or the universe.
Yeah. Well, a couple of your songs mention Mary, so there's at least an inclusion of Christian themes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't escape that because that's what I was born with, and you know, after a certain point when I said, you know, I don't want to be a part of the Catholic Church anymore, and I'm going to explore all these other religions, I want to see what they have in common, I want to see what the common thread there is. And then that was great, but then eventually I learned, you know, I can't just dig out my roots and toss them in a big bonfire. They're always going to be there, and, you know, and if I tried to do that, that would really accomplish nothing, you know, and just take up an entire new mythology with a whole new set of symbols from another side of the world that I wasn't raised with, and it would always be a stranger inside my internal home, so to speak. So I'm fine with carrying on some of those symbols, and Mary being, I think, a great symbol for the Sacred Mother, the creator of all of all that is. And it's the mystery is, of course, that there was no conception for this creation, you know. And that's the what I like about the symbol, the image, the icon of the Mother of God. And from my tradition, that's Mary.
When you went exploring the other religious expressions,
mm-hmm.
were you writing music while you were doing it?
Oh, always.
So did those other expressions come into what you were writing?
I suppose
somewhere back there in Kuhar, is there a Buddhist, you know?
No, I don't think let me take that back. I recalled this the recent, because I've been thinking about all the songs that I want to do tomorrow night. And I remember there was a song, and there's a line in it, old man, sick man, dead man, I see. And life is a burden and a disease. And the Buddha goes out into the world, and he before he becomes the Buddha, and he sees an old man, a sick man, and a dead man. You know, and that's what eventually calls him out of his father's house, out of the temple, to say, well, wait a second, life isn't just all this, and it's in this temple here. There's more, and I got to find out what that is. So yes, to answer your question, yes.
So when you now we're here and it's the 21st century and it's 2013. When you step up to the microphone with your guitar in your hand and you're going to sing, is all of that exploration and growth, do you bring that to each song? Or when you sing something from 20 years ago, are you back there, or are you here with new insights?
I think it's both. A good song that you can sing again and again and again is a song that keeps giving to you as the artist, as the singer. Because when you're inspired to write a song and it just comes out of you, seemingly out of nowhere, that's a really beautiful thing. And sometimes it's full of a lot of emotion, makes you cry, makes you feel really good, it stirs up a profound feeling. And those are you know, when you have those songs, they're very special songs, and they stick with you, and as you continue to sing them over the years, they keep telling you something that you didn't know before somehow.
That's okay. So this is what I was driving toward, I think, is do you do the song differently? You must, because your voice has changed, your playing is mm-hmm. different, you've learned more about the guitar, etc. But my question is, do you hear that other voice?
The voice from 10,
yeah.
15 years ago?
Yeah. How much
not,
of it?
Not per se when I'm actually singing it. If I'm listening to a recording, then certainly I hear that other voice. And sometimes, you know, just the song itself can take me back to a place. And I can remember, I don't necessarily remember how I felt when I wrote the song, but I might remember taking a break from writing it and driving down to the 7-Eleven and getting a cup of coffee or something. You know, just peculiar little details that stay in my internal eye. So pop up.
Now, you've done at least two scores for silent films. Mm-hmm. You did Nosferatu, and then you just recently did another one.
Oh, no, we just did Nosferatu past one, and the year before was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, Caligari, okay. So how does that contrast with your singing?
Well, generally in the movie scores, I there's not any singing.
I understand, but I'm talking about the music, the musical experience.
Oh, Well, how does it contrast?
And I guess maybe another way to ask the question is, how do the two inform each other?
Well, you know, it's empathy. Sometimes when you're writing a song to sing, you may not be writing it about yourself. You might be writing it about somebody else. And that's what you're doing when you're composing a score. You see the characters and you get inside of them, and they inspire you to create a sound.
Okay. So you said you're writing a song like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I heard you talking about the composition process that you did for Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that you were watching the film, and as the scene unfolded, you were interpreting it musically. And it sounds to me like those are the same things.
Well,
in a different expression.
Yeah, it certainly can be. It certainly can be. And ultimately, and this is why Nosferatu worked really good for Bridget and myself, is we really like the movie. And of course, why do we like it? Because it speaks to us and we feel connected to it. There's something about that story that we feel like is a part of us. And that's why we like it. And that's why we want to see that part of us being thrown up on the screen with those images. And so, you know, and you have to like a movie to write a score to. Well, you don't have to. it's best if you do like it.
Yeah, because you got to watch it about 300 times.
Yeah.
In order to... Anyway, okay. Well, I don't want to pin you down too hard, but I wanted to ask, when did you record House of Bread? When's this song?
Was actually recorded almost exactly a year ago. It was my birthday show last year.
Okay. When did you write it?
The year before that.
The year before that. Okay. So we're going to play a little of it. And I want to see, I want to ask you a question about it when we hear it. So here we go with House of Bread. So this is George Kuhar singing House of Bread. He composed it 2 years ago. He played it last year at his birthday party. You going to play it again?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So why'd you write it?
I don't know why.
Okay.
I do. I have an image in my mind of when I wrote it, though.
Okay.
I remember it being the winter time and the winter sun peeking through the snowy trees. And I had a book lying on the bed that had a man on the cover of it, and a pyramid and a palm tree. And yeah, and that image always comes to mind whenever I sing the song.
Remember the book?
I got it at Rainy Retreat, Rainy Day Retreat.
Yeah.
And
so the visual image that gave you the song and the
I can't
setting.
Say that it gave it, but maybe it was it tuned me into the frequency so that I could pick it up from the other side, I guess.
Okay. One of the things I notice about your music when I listen to it is that what's the right term here? You're almost hesitant to do a chord change. A lot of your compositions stay on a single note or in a single chord
mm-hmm.
for much longer than, like, rock wood or other things. Are you conscious that you do that?
Well, that's kind of, I think that's a product of the nature of my instrument. I was kind of forced to switch my acoustic guitar, which would normally have six strings on it, and I was forced into playing it with four strings. And that was an I have this what's called an arterial vascular fistula in my left hand, which is something that I got when I was receiving dialysis treatments. And it's still there. I would like to have the surgery undone someday. Of course, my doctors are hesitant to do that because I have a kidney transplant, and if something happened, mm-hmm. It'd be great to still have it. Otherwise, I'd have to put one in my leg or something. So because of that, I don't have the gripping power that I used to have in my left hand. And it was kind of by accident that I found out, it's much easier for me to play with four strings. So I just abandoned the bottom, the two lower strings, and then just play on the four higher strings. And it actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because then it opened up my acoustic guitar to be this whole new instrument to me. Whereas, you know, before maybe I'd maxed out what I could do on my instrument. But now it's changed. And so what you said about the single chord thing, often there's a drone kind of note, and that's the D string, mm-hmm. and it kind of functions as a drone, while the other three strings can move around some. And that's just a product of necessity, that I can't hold down bar chords on my acoustic guitar. My electric guitar, a little bit more so, but you know, because they're less physically demanding to play. But the acoustic guitar, necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, what a marvelous adaptation it turned out to be, because it really creates a sound for you that's, you know, I can spot your songs in just a few bars.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, because I'm hearing, you know, that pattern, and I'm thinking, and you did the same thing when you did the Nosferatu score. I heard it in there, even though you're on keyboard, I think, for that. But there were lots of scenes there, and I understand that probably it's tied to the visual as well, where you have to hold the same melodic pattern for a long period of time, repeating it over and over while the thing develops, and then suddenly there'll be a chord change because suddenly something shifts on the screen. It was interesting because it sounds like the same thing. I was noticing a lot of similarity between the two, which is why I was asking you how the two kind of inform each other, because I think that's part of the clue. George, your concert is tomorrow night?
That is correct.
And it's at?
The Rookery.
Okay.
Which is in the Valentine Building.
Tight space in there, so if you want to do this, you got to get there at what time? Get your cup of coffee and get relaxed and settle down.
Well, you know, they have a beer and wine license now, too.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. And you can get a pizza, too, I think.
Yeah, okay.
So, show up a little bit before 7, I'll be walking around and saying hi to my friends and get started a little bit after 7.
A little bit after 7, and what do you think? You're going until 3, 4, or 5 in the morning?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, good enough. Well, great opportunity, George Kuhar. You doing solo, or
it's just me.
Okay, she's not joining you? You're not doing a double or anything like that?
No,
okay.
It's my party.
All right, okay. Well, so come to George Kuhar's almost birthday party tomorrow night at the Rookery, and join him. You get there about 6:45 or so, grab a cup of coffee, settle down with George for a couple of minutes until he starts playing and like that. Good to have you on the show.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Let's move to Writer's Almanac here.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 4th of January, 2013. It's the birthday of historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, born Brooklyn, 1943. Author of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Came out in 2005, was widely talked about around Washington, a book about how Abraham Lincoln built an alliance made up of his former enemies. Doris Goodwin said, "Lincoln's political genius was rooted in his remarkable array of emotional strengths, which enabled him to form friendships with rivals who had previously disdained him, to put past grudges aside, to assume responsibility for the failure of subordinates, to share credit with ease, and to learn from mistakes. It's the birthday of Sir Isaac Newton, born in Woolsthorpe, England, 1643. He was a premature baby. It was said that he was so small he could fit into a quart pot. He studied mathematics, physics, on his own, developed his theories of gravity and optics. He invented the reflecting telescope. And at the age of 43, Newton published his Principia, which overturned nearly everything then believed about the universe up to that point. He proved that the celestial bodies were governed by the same laws of physics as objects on Earth. He incorporated Kepler's laws of planetary motion into his own theories about gravity and established his own three laws of motion. Sir Isaac Newton, who wrote, "I do not know what I may appear to the world to be, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered around me." It's the birthday of Jakob Grimm, the elder of the brothers Grimm, born in Hanau, Germany, 1785, who, along with his brother, gathered oral folktales in several volumes called Children's and Household Tales, including Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Rumpelstiltskin, Rapunzel, many others, stories that have been significantly toned down over the years from the violent versions that the Grimm brothers knew. Here's a poem for today by Billy Collins, "The Fish." As soon as the elderly waiter placed before me the fish I had ordered, it began to stare up at me with its one flat, iridescent eye. "I feel sorry for you," it seemed to say, "eating alone in this awful restaurant, bathed in such unkindly light and surrounded by these dreadful murals of Sicily. And I feel sorry for you, too, yanked from the sea and now lying dead next to some boiled potatoes in Pittsburgh," I said back to the fish as I raised my fork. And thus my dinner in an unfamiliar city with its rivers and lighted bridges was graced not only with chilled wine and lemon slices, but with compassion and sorrow, even after the waiter removed my plate, with the head of the fish still staring and the barrel vault of its delicate bones terribly exposed, save for a shroud of parsley. Billy Collins' poem, "The Fish," from Ballistics, published by Random House and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Four minutes to 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest has, he has one name, but he does it in two languages. My guest is Lance Twitchell, who is also known as Kone. Did I do okay?
Yeah.
Hey, we had a brief pronunciation lesson before we opened the microphones here. Lance is teaching Alaska Native Language courses out at UAS, and let's get the commercial over with first. What are you offering this
sure.
semester?
Yeah, we really want to promote some of our courses. We've had a really good turnout this last semester, and every year we kind of see the numbers dip a little bit in the spring, so we're trying to get the word out. Especially, this is the first year in a while that we've offered a four-credit HIDTA class. So there's AKL 108, which is elementary HIDTA. And if you can get on board with that, it's the second semester of HIDTA, then that would set you up for the next year, the sequence of HIDTA, moving up to intermediate. So we're really excited about building a pocket of HIDTA speakers and doing what we can. Ben Young is teaching that class from Indiana, so he's finishing his bachelor's degree, and he took time off to study intensively with his grandfather and really just sort of figure out his language skills and become one of the only younger HIDTA speakers in the world. You know, so we've got about six speakers of HIDTA left, so we're really trying to make a push and say, you know, if you want to learn the language, it's right here. We also have Southeast Alaska Native Song and Dance with Lyle James, where students can interact with language and culture in a way that's just extremely physical. And so students are dancing, they're learning songs, they're learning protocols involving being in a dance group. And then they're also realizing how the language functions in that. The first semester of that class, students made their own drum. This semester they'll be making a drum bag and some regalia. And then, you know, starting to learn some songs and learn the aspects of what it means to get up in front of people and to sing our songs. And not just in performance, but also in ceremony. We also have a STAT class on Friday nights, which is a lower-level Tlingit for the family and home, an upper-level Tlingit for the dormant speaker. In this class, we're trying to take...
We should mention a stacked class basically offers credit for like freshmen in one section and juniors and seniors in the second.
Yes.
But
yes.
It's the same class.
Exactly.
Just,
so
yeah.
If you don't have a lot of language skills, you could take the 100 level. If you feel pretty comfortable, you could take the 200 level. And what this class seeks to do is try and create a non-classroom atmosphere for the language. And it's a trial run for us to figure out some different teaching techniques. One thing we really want to do is push the language back into the home and figure out how people can interact and just stay in the language when they're at home. You know, I mean, we've been running immersion camps and things like that, but our idea is to move beyond that and just say we're just living in our language. We don't need immersion camps. We just need to live in our language. And then the second one targets what we call a dormant speaker or a latent speaker, which is someone who grew up speaking the language but now find themselves... They can't, you know, or don't. And then that kind of person can understand Tlingit when you speak to them. And it's really an interesting phenomenon. It exists quite a lot in within indigenous languages, just because all of the social stuff surrounding language loss, and in particular not loss, but language, what we call language murder, is that you end up with populations that just have these different mental blocks, but it's a different type of teaching that would get that population speaking. And then in addition, we have Alaska Native Oratory, which is a one-credit class, and you could learn these different aspects of oratory and play a part in the oratory competition, which takes place in March. And also, we have Documenting Alaska Native Languages. Alice Taff has been working with us for some time and has done just phenomenal projects documenting elders, and so you get to learn different techniques on how to document a language and also take a look at what's been going on and contribute to some of the body of work that we have. And we have a number of speakers who are just phenomenal and are no longer with us, but we're able to record some really important conversations with them.
Is there a major?
Yeah, well, now...
Can you get a degree in Tlingit language or in native languages?
So now there's a dedicated emphasis area within our Bachelor of Liberal Arts.
Okay.
So that's the first step. So you can come in and get a Bachelor of Liberal Arts, and your primary emphasis is Alaska Native Languages and Studies. So this puts us on track to really develop a full bachelor's degree, which is what we're hoping to do. You know, it's not going to be an easy thing to do. The climate's just a little bit difficult to develop new programs, but I think it's necessary. I think... You wouldn't need to add to any of the classes that we teach, but we would certainly, you know, do some classes that we feel need to be taught. But for a long time, they've just called it anthropology or archaeology, but they've been really teaching about Alaska Native and Native American people. And so we have the first students this year ever at UAS who have signed on to that type of degree program. We're really targeting people who want to work within Native communities or with Native communities and just really emphasize that this is a valid area of study. There's a lot of stuff to explore here, and it's a very professional degree. It's not a degree that you just do because it's something that you're casually interested in. But if you looked at Alaska Native tribes, corporations, other organizations, if you added them all together, you might have the single largest economic group in Alaska. Mm-hmm. They've just been divided into all these little pieces so you can't see it.
So registration is like underway right now?
Yeah.
Can people still register for these classes?
Yep, you can register up until after classes start. And so we'll be kicking off right in mid-January and around the 14th. And you can register up until that time. You can, you know, and we have a dynamic group of teachers, of students, and we're really starting to gain some momentum with getting students committed to taking language beyond just classroom use and figuring out how to be fluent. And so every semester we have students who design their own projects, and their projects are things that they want to do so that they can take the language with them. So we have students who are playing sari in Tlingit. We have students who are playing basketball in Tlingit. We have students who are making movies in Tlingit, which are fantastic, and you see them on YouTube. And so it's exciting to see it becoming this living, breathing language, where it was this thing that was increasingly less and less available. And so, you know, it's an exciting time. So run out, register, show up for classes, see if it's your thing, and talk to us about registration options. There's plenty of organizations that have stepped forward to help sponsor students. The university is coming up with ways to make these classes more affordable so that students can enroll and not worry about the money problem, because we're looking at a very different situation as opposed to some other different areas.
Okay, good. Well, registration's open. Classes are being held. It sounds like a fascinating program is underway at the University of Alaska. Thank you so much for bringing us news about this.
All right.
Sheesh. 11 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Our music today is from an album by Dave Haskell, the Dave Haskell Group. We talked about it a little bit before. We just had an update on the weather forecast. Looks like we're looking at mostly cloudy, but patchy fog this evening. Scattered rain, snow showers late. Lows 30 to 35 this evening. Those will slowly rise overnight with east winds coming up 10 to 20 miles per hour. And then Saturday we'll see snow in the morning and then rain in the afternoon. We're looking at about an inch of snow, the snow level rising up to about 1,100 feet, and highs 34 to 35 with east winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. So it still doesn't look like Eagle Crest gets their dream season, but it's going to be a little bit of snow. My next guest is here to tell us about a thing in Juneau called the Co-op Nursery School. And Evelyn Bass is, she wears two hats. She's the program director and she's also the registration coordinator. And I guess the primary reason that Evelyn is among us today is because they actually have some openings in the co-op school, I guess.
We do. We definitely have some openings on Mondays and Thursdays coming up this next semester, which starts on January 7th, but we're going to accept later registration. So anybody who's interested can contact me. And we might have openings come open on the other days. So if folks are interested in other days, that's a possibility.
So, Evelyn, how does a co-op preschool work?
Well, it's run by the parents, but you don't work every day. So it gives you a chance to get some things done while leaving your kids with other parents who've had a background check and who are leading an activity and bringing a snack. And so about a third of the time, you're staying and you're either in charge of running a small activity or bringing a snack. And we keep a ratio of three kids for every one adult. So usually the classes have six kids and two adults will stay each time. And the kids have a great time. They love it. So it's a great way to kind of get them in this peer environment and very gently structured environment at a really low cost.
Is there training? I mean, if you are a parent and you are nervous about being responsible for six kids instead of maybe one kid, does somebody come in and kind of hold your hand through that process?
Not exactly. What you could do if that were the situation is ask to be scheduled out a month or two after you start and maybe stay once or twice and just see what the other parents are doing. And it actually comes a lot more naturally than you'd expect. And I was nervous myself because I don't do a lot of crafts or those types of activities with my daughter. So I didn't know what I was going to do. But it, you know, things work out. We have a binder of activity ideas. We have a book of activity ideas. And then there's times like my mom was taking my daughter one day and didn't have an activity. So we just brought a radio with a CD and some scarves. And she just had the kids dancing and throwing the scarves in the air. And they loved it.
The best toy in the world is a cardboard box. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I think it's just being together. The kids love it. They have a blast.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like you grew into this yourself.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Yeah, I was... I expressed some interest in it last year, and it turned out they needed a new program director, and I sort of fell into it. So, yeah.
So all of a sudden, you're in charge.
Exactly.
How many total children are at the preschool?
Each day, there's six. Has a limit of six, although sometimes it's up to eight because you can be a sub. For example, on Fridays, we're totally full with the six. But there's other kids who are interested in coming on Fridays, and so their parents can be subs, and they can either drop their kids off on days when other kids aren't coming, or they can just bring their kid anytime they want, any Friday they want, and stay. And so we do have a full eight kids on Fridays, and we have nearly full days on Mondays and Thursdays. And right now, Tuesdays and Wednesdays were one of those days was happening last semester. It's not right now, but if we had enough interest, we could start those days up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So some of it just depends on how many people are interested.
Yeah. I think it fluctuates year to year. And so I've heard sometimes it's like 5 days a week, six kids, and sometimes they're kind of struggling to get a full 3 days, which is what we like to keep. Is at least three full days.
Yeah. We'll say this again before we leave the topic, but if someone's interested, they call you?
Yeah, they can either call me or email me. My number is 957-6459, and the email is junocoopnurseryschool at gmail.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the age that you're aiming at?
Mainly it's 18 months to 3 years. We're thinking about, you know, there are some kids who've been going and they just turned three. And so we're really considering allowing young three-year-olds to continue because they love it, and it's still appropriate to have them there depending on the class, as long as it's not a huge age gap with the other kids in the day they've chosen. It could work out. So if there's anyone who has a kid who just turned three, we're considering allowing that. So.
I know it isn't your business, but let's say that I've had a child in the preschool for a year or so, and now the kid is three. What are my options? Can I move on to something else if I don't stay with you?
Well, there's the preschool, which I think the nursery school developed as sort of a secondary to the preschool.
I see.
And the preschool, you're eligible for the preschool at age three, and that's in the same building. They're both held in the Northern Lights Church downtown. And the preschool is also a co-op. And I'm not 100% positive how it works because I haven't yet gotten involved in it.
But, okay.
Yeah.
But it's down the hall.
It's down the hall, yeah.
Okay, cool. So this is, how did this thing get started?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how it got started, but I know it was a long time ago. It was almost 40 years ago, and so there are folks whose kids are going now who went themselves. And I heard the program director from last year knows some of those folks, and she said that they just report that they have lifelong friendships from the kids they were in the co-op nursery school and the co-op preschool with. Yeah.
So the person that you get paired up with for your weekly sessions could turn out to be someone that you spend a lot of time with.
I think just developing those friendships at such a young age, the kids really do just become buddies. And my daughter talks about her friends all week. She can't wait to see them again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can you describe the environment a little bit more? Can you tell me what it looks like or where you are? Where are these? Where's the preschool held? It's in Northern Light United Church, but is it downstairs or up?
Yeah, if you go into Northern Lights Church, it's downstairs in their nursery school, in their nursery room, and the room just is filled with toys. It has a tiny little. It also has a little bathroom for little ones with a tiny little toilet that they can use to potty train or to use if they already know how to do that. And there's a slide, and there's a small house. So there's just a bunch of toys that the kids can run around and do. And then when we're ready to do snack or activity, we bring them to the table. There's a table in there. And it's just so very gently structured. I think it's a really good introduction to them about what it's going to be like to go into preschool and then to school. And we also can take breaks and go use the climbing room, which they love, or sometimes if it's free, there's a room upstairs that we can take a bunch of little toy cars up in and get a little more rowdy. And on nice days, we can also take them out to the playground.
Oh, okay. There is a playground.
There is a playground.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Enclosed?
Okay. No, it's not, so it has to be a nice day.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, or they've got to have great gear with them.
Okay. So this sounds like a really terrific thing. There's a charge for this, though, right?
Yeah.
This is not free.
It's not free.
It is
free.
A co-op, right?
It's a co-op, and so the charge is not that much. It's just really to keep things going. We have a few little fees we have to pay, you know, each year, and so it's $50 per child per day. So I have my daughter in on Fridays. So for the whole semester, it's $50 for her to be able to participate.
Okay.
Last semester, I also had her in on Mondays, so I had her in 2 days, and that second day was $40 for the whole semester.
Semester is from January 7th through late May.
That's
for
right.
The spring semester.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So contact you. Again, your telephone number is?
957-6459.
Okay.
And the email is junocoopnurseryschool@gmail.com.
Okay, cool. This sounds like a really terrific program. Thank you so much for coming in and telling us a little bit about it. We have a little piece of appropriate music here for the piece here. Thanks, Evelyn.
Thank you.
Big sea lion lying around with your big fat body spread all over the ground. You're a big hunk of blubber when you lie on the beach, but when you jump in the water,
you glide gracefully like a dance beneath the sea. You are made to swim the ocean waters free. Is it fun?
Big Sea Lion, a little piece of music to get us from preschool to tomorrow's show. Well, actually, let's see. It looks like, Monday. Tuesday's Mudroom event, Amanda Compton and Katie Spielberg will be here to talk about it. Carter Sample will be here to highlight the Bartlett Tobacco Cessation Program. Rory Darling will be in to talk about the Juno Bridge Club and Big Sisters, Big Brothers, Big Brothers, Big Sisters National Mentoring Month. Rachel Gearhart and her little sister will be here to talk about that. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas, and KTOO also broadcasts on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can hear us on K276 AF at 103.1 megahertz. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210 AS at 89.9. We're also on digital channel 871. KRNN is on digital channel 872. And KXLL is on digital channel 873 on GCI cable. Pat Moore, been your host today for Juno Afternoon. Thanks for tuning in.